Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And wow, it just seems like the winter holidays, Hanukkah, Christmas, are over, and we're already heading down the pike to the spring holidays. Except we're bypassing Valentine's Day for some reason this year. We didn't get any Valentine interviews in here.
I don't know. Maybe we're falling out of love with Valentine's Day. Who knows?
Well, it's always the same chocolate stuff, you know. But
and
anyhow,
the good news is that other traditional holidays like Easter and Passover, which is the subject of the first interview, are going from strength to strength in terms of new interpretations, interesting things that one can do. Instead of the same boring old thing.
We're talking specifically of Passover, and we're talking specifically of Paula Scheuer, who's known primarily for baking, but she's done a food savory book and very creative, the new Passover menu, and she did a great job of that. Let's listen to that. Paula Scheuer is known for her sweets. She's the author of the Holiday Kosher Baker book, and she's broken out in a number of different directions in this current book, which is called The New Passover Menu. Paula, it's a masterpiece. It's really, listeners, this is going to save your life for the holidays, believe me. You said it didn't even take you that long to write, Paula.
Okay, well, the idea for this book was in my head for a while, but right when the Holiday Kosher Baker came out in November of 2013, I was in San Diego for a bunch of book events and a television appearance, and my editor called me and said, would you be interested in writing a Passover book? And I said, well, what do you mean? I just did 45 Passover desserts in the holiday book. He said, no, a food book. And I said, a food book? So I sat down in a Mexican restaurant and started outlining my whole vision for Passover, and I realized that I had all these recipes in my head that I made for my family all the time, and on all holidays, and especially on Passover, the ones that were appropriate for the holiday. And so I wrote the book in about 6 months because I just had to put on paper all the recipes that I make all the time.
Plus you had a deadline, right?
The deadline was actually Passover last year, so that was kind of
funny.
So my kids were eating Passover food from basically November through April.
Yeah, and you have four kids.
I have four kids, yeah. One's in college
and
my daughter, and now I have three boys at home.
Oh, lucky you.
Oh, I'm very lucky because you know what? When you bake and cook as much as I do, and you test as often as I do, you need people to eat it.
Exactly.
Oh, I bet they're good. I bet they're good at that, right?
They are uniquely talented at that.
Yeah. Well, we spent Christmas with my brother and his family, which includes three boys. And you've never seen food disappear so fast in your whole life. and your guys are just the same, I guess, right?
Yeah, three teenage boys. Yeah, it's interesting. They don't eat so much, but they just want to have good food around.
Now, first of all, let's start with the very basics. I said you really don't like easy things because you pick a holiday and a food event that is so surrounded by tradition and then set off to update it, keeping some traditions, but also not only updating it to modern sensibilities, but also broadening it, spreading around to different parts of the world. You have a global view of what's served over for Passover.
Well, I think that today, in order to keep like young people interested in the Jewish food traditions, I think you still have to update them just a little bit. People want enough reminders of their grandmother's tables, but then they want something that reflects the world they live in today, the kind of food they cook, the kind of food they watch on TV, the kind of food that they see online. They want bright, beautiful food, and they want it healthy, and they don't want to fuss too much to make everybody happy in creating this book.
Can you give us an example of, say, a traditional dish that you didn't include and a new one that you did include to illustrate that point?
Well, I guess that, you know, I can kind of sort of answer your question by talking about kugel. Now, kugel is a very traditional Eastern European Jewish dish, and people make so many different kinds of kugels. It's basically like a pudding. So my mother used to make a noodle kugel that had cinnamon and raisins and apples. my grandmother and my mother and me as well make one with cottage cheese and sugar and sour cream and butter that's really sweet. People make kugels out of vegetables. Now, I only make them maybe once or twice a year because they're not so healthy and they're kind of just heavy food. So when I look at Passover, I'm thinking, okay, so we can't have pasta, we can't have bread, but we can have all these wonderful vegetables. But every time I try to create menus without, or even when I've written books and not have kugel in them, I get a lot of resistance out there. People in the Jewish community love kugel. So I didn't want to put a kugel recipe in the book, but I basically was bullied into it by people in the Midwest, people, friends of mine around the country who said, you can't write a Passover book without kugel. Just like I was told I couldn't write the Holiday Kosher Baker without a honey cake recipe. And I ended up with honey cake cookies. So for the Passover book, people bugged me about kugel, but I created one that has so many vegetables, very little matzah meal, which is like the kind of the basis of many kugels, and I was happy with it. So I included it. It really doesn't look like your Bubby's kugel, but it looks like kugel. So yeah, that was kind of like, okay, I'll agree with you that it should be there, but it's going to be in my own fashion. It's going to be a little bit healthier and more loaded with healthy ingredients.
But now, you just start out with table of contents. It really sort of organizes people if they just look at it to start with. Tell us a little bit about the organization of this book and what you include in it.
So Passover is an eight-day holiday, and it's a holiday where so many people entertain lots and lots of people. So what I wanted to do was write a book that made this holiday easier, basically set you free from the oppression of Passover's past. So I organized the book into two menus for the Seder, one that's like a Ashkenazi Eastern European menu but updated, and then a global international type of menu. And then there's usually a Shabbat in the middle of the eight-day holiday, so you need a menu for that. And at the end of the week, we have two more holiday days called Yom Tov, where people don't work and they go to synagogue and pray. So I have menus for those days. And then we have weekday menus. And what I did with the weekday menus, which are French, Italian vegetarian, barbecue, and easy chicken, there are menus you could use for a Seder if you're vegetarian, or if you want a dairy menu for a lunch one day, you would have that. So the recipes are organized by menus. Every recipe tells you the equipment you need and prep time and cook time and what you can do in advance. I just wanted to make it very accessible to all levels of cook.
Yeah, you have so many helpful hints in here, like cleaning leeks. Leeks are not as common in this country as they are in a lot of parts of the world.
I would agree with that, and that is unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people probably don't know what to do, and they end up with a lot of gritty stuff.
Right. So, yeah, no, I think it's important to know that you need to slice into it, open up the layers, and get the water through there, or slice it and soak it so you can make sure there's no dirt lingering in there.
I think, didn't Dana Cowan tell us about that? She said that was one of her mistakes.
Oh, right, yeah.
She's the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine magazine. She just wrote a book all about the mistakes that she made.
And one of them was leeks,
and
yeah,
that was one that she said that she forgot to get the dirt out of the leeks.
Oh, my.
And I've been very careful with I've been very careful with that since then. I think lot of times you can get away with it because you cut most of the dirt's mostly in the green part anyway, and you really throw a lot of that away.
Right, but that's not where all of the dirt is. When I was in cooking school, which was mostly dessert, but we did some food as well, when we washed herbs, lettuce, and sliced leeks, we would soak it in water like a salad spinner bowl. So we have the basket and the container, soak it with water, move it around, and then lift up the basket and look in the water. If we saw dirt, we dumped out the water, rinsed that out exterior bowl, filled it with water, and did the same thing again until the water was clear. For people who are kosher, who are not permitted to eat bugs and want to make sure there's no bugs in their food and their greens and their herbs and any other vegetable, we do the same method. We soak it, then we pick it up and say, okay, the water's clean, then there's no bugs there.
What recipe actually did you view as like your major triumph of combining tradition and contemporary appetites?
I would say that would have to, there's probably several, but the one that stands out for me is the Seder plate salad.
Okay, I thought that right away too. All right.
Yeah, first of all, if you look at it, it's just a beautiful salad.
Exactly.
It's got roasted lamb, hard-boiled eggs, bright greens, and all kinds of other ingredients. So on a typical Seder plate, we have a hard-boiled egg, celery, or romaine lettuce. We have a shank bone like lamb. We have a haroset dish that looks like the mortar the Israelites used to build bricks during their period of slavery, made out of walnuts and apples and wine. We also have maror, which is a bitter herb, usually white horseradish, and parsley, which we dip in water. So I created a salad using all those elements. There's celery, there's apples, there's walnuts, there's the roasted meat, there's hard-boiled egg, and then the salad dressing is made out of the Manischewitz sweet wine combined with the white horseradish and some other ingredients.
Now, what about the serving thing? Did you design that?
Oh, on the cover? Oh, that is from a ceramicist in Israel whose name is Ivy Dashti. And my friend lent me the Seder plate, and we just loved it. And my editors just thought it was so beautiful and really represented kind of that old and new coming together.
And you have a number of important supporters, including Gil Marks. Is he not amazing?
Gil was a very, very special person, and so sad that he passed away last December.
Yeah.
He left a legacy of spectacular Jewish information, history about Jewish food, recipes galore. His Olive Trees and Honey is just one of my favorite books.
Yeah, well, his encyclopedia, we interviewed him about that.
Oh, that's lovely.
And it was, you talk about a major research job. That was
amazing. Oh, my. You want to know the history of hot dogs? You can read 4 pages on that. It's really quite something. But he and I were big fans of each other's work, and it meant a lot to me to have his endorsement.
Right. Now, I think that people are not always tuned in to the global influences. But I've known some Iraqi Jews, and I'm not surprised by it. But you have a lot of Middle Eastern dishes, like Moroccan spiced short ribs in here.
Yeah,
I never got that for Seder.
No, and that's the thing. So what is the Moroccan spiced short rib? So I'm taking a meat that we grew up on eating, a meat called flanken, which is basically the strips with the small bones, and they would boil it back in the old country. A lot of Eastern European people my generation grew up eating that boiled meat with red horseradish, like when we were kids and teenagers, and it was taking that same meat that was all very Jewish and turning it into like a really nice short rib recipe using a combination of Moroccan spices. Jewish people come from all over the world and they bring their food traditions with them everywhere they go. So I think you're hard pressed to find a family that's only cooking food from one part of the world.
Right.
They might have gone to a cousin's house who married somebody who's Moroccan and tried something there. And then their in-laws could be from South America and they might have learned a Peruvian dish. So
yeah.
I think that people really want to honor all the different parts of the world where Jewish people have lived and people who really still want to keep those food traditions from other places. And I thought Passover is a great time for that.
Yeah, I'm interested in the Peruvian chicken with a salsa verde, is it?
Yeah, that is one of our best recipes. It's from our wonderful babysitter, Betty Supo, who's from Peru, and we just love this chicken. And we normally cook it with rice, but I realized that and the sauce was so perfect for Passover, and also a really nice recipe to serve for a springtime holiday, a little less heavy than some other kinds of chicken recipes.
So these are not just recipes that you can use for Passover. You can cook with them 366 days a year.
You know, whether you're Jewish or not, whether you're celebrating Passover or not, I mean, I would pick up these are the recipes that I make for my family all year round.
Now,
and that's why I was able to write the book so fast. These recipes were in my head. I'm a very precise baker, but when I go in the refrigerator at night to plan dinner, I basically make soup and salads and stews out of whatever happens to be there, and I don't really measure. So when the editor came to me and said, okay, write this food book, I thought, oh, I'm actually going to have to measure soup and salad dressing? These are the kinds of dishes that we all throw things into, but I measured.
Yeah, you have to be really precise when you're writing a cookbook because you don't know what the reader actually knows.
Oh, yeah. Now, when I get emails from readers with wonderful questions and great comments, but I also hear from people who just don't want to follow recipes.
It's like me when I make my famous chicken soup. First thing to do is get the largest pot we own because I know somehow or other I'm going to fill it.
Oh, yeah, chicken soup is another thing. Like, chicken soup, I just look in my fridge and throw everything in the pot, but I actually had to write down a recipe. I did it painstakingly, and I'm so excited because now not only my family, but everyone in the world will be able to make these delicious, simple, easy, fresh recipes.
I'm looking at the Italian vegetarian menu. Now, of course, the Mediterranean diet is always heavy on vegetables, but it seemed odd somehow to have a holiday Italian meal that's vegetarian.
Well, there are a lot of vegetarian people in the Jewish community and who make seders that are vegetarian. And because Passover is a long holiday, it's 8 days long, you need other options for lunchtime as well. Like, that menu is such a great lunch menu. Not even all of it. You could just make the eggplant and serve it with the antipasti, and that's a meal.
Explain again. I never understood that you couldn't have pasta.
Oh, okay, because when the Israelites were departing from Egypt, they didn't have time to bake their bread, and so the bread didn't rise, and that's why they ate matzah, and that's why we eat matzah.
Yeah, but you don't put yeast and leavening in pasta, do you?
No, but we don't eat any, other than matzah, we don't eat any other food products made from grain. Not from wheat, barley, spelt, oats on Passover.
Really?
The rabbis basically extrapolated from you're going to eat matzah for 8 days into we're not going to eat anything made out of kind of bread products.
So the whole thing is like a traditional statement.
Absolutely. So the 8 days is it's a different diet because we're not eating foods that we normally eat. We don't have challah. We're not eating any pasta. Eastern European Jews do not eat rice or legumes.
Right.
So it's really, we're down to the proteins and the vegetables, which is honestly not that hard for people like me who, that's our normal eating the whole rest of the year.
Well, there's in the press release we got, there's a list of some of these outstanding recipes. I think that if people are only familiar with with latkes, they're going to be really surprised by some of the recipes that you've included, such as lamb stew with apricots, pear, and mint. Now, that's beautiful.
Oh, it's so delicious. It's a wonderful recipe. Yeah, that one I really enjoyed working on. Yeah, no, I really love, this is how I eat. I just eat really fresh food.
Well, I'd like to come to your house, Paula Scheuer.
Hey, everybody wants to come to my house. They don't always want to invite me over because no one wants to feed a chef, but
for sure
everybody wants to come here.
But we don't
especially
get invited
when I'm
either.
Testing out recipes.
Well, you need a lot of mouths for that. So
we do. And, you know, when we shot this book probably over 3 days. We did the food parts over 2 days.
Oh, my God.
Maybe we did one on a Monday, one on a Thursday, but we had so much leftover food.
Oh,
we just
goodness.
Had these wonderful meals, my family, at the end of the day. You know, people said, oh, you can invite us over, we'll eat. And I was just so tired. So the five of us sat down and had wonderful food after we took the pictures.
Well, the pictures are gorgeous and the mouth-watering. And I don't want to end this before mentioning that you don't skimp on your desserts either. You have wonderful desserts.
No, I have 15 new desserts and a breakfast chapter.
Right.
So never run out of dessert ideas, but I really love this dessert chapter. And I felt that breakfast was something we needed to include as well for Passover because we don't eat, cold cereal. And you can make Passover pancakes. I have a recipe for waffles here, but I wanted breakfast options as well. Yeah, I just want to make Passover easier.
Yeah, and
I've always promoted Passover on my website, thekosherbaker.com,
yeah.
You know, with desserts and stuff. But I'm just so excited to put my food recipes out there because everybody kept asking me, when are you going to do a food book? So here I am.
Yeah.
I did a food book.
And also, you're right on tap here for most of these, or many of these, are gluten-free, which is another issue today.
I would say almost the entire book is gluten-free.
Yeah.
The only reason there are some non-gluten-free recipes, one was the kugel that has matzah meal in it, and then I have a few dessert recipes that have gluten so that I could have recipes that were also nut-free.
Well, you did a crack-up job as usual, not surprised.
Well, I'm very excited I'm getting ready to get on the road to promote the book at a lot of places in the country and a couple of TV appearances, so it's all very exciting.
Well, you go, Paula.
Thank you, Anne.
It's always so winner.
Great to be on your show.
Yeah, Paula, and this is a winner. Congratulations. And
well,
good luck with your tour.
The book's out, and people should get it and use it for Passover and really all year round.
And we'll be back with another interesting story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You know, usually I can tell from the material that I'm sent in advance about these books what's going to be a book to love or not, but this next one was a real sleeper. I was really surprised to get it to find out how totally engrossing it was going to be. Of course, the author, Deirdre Hecken, is both articulate and charismatic, along with a very interesting subject. And you'll find a delight in this book, as I did, I'm sure, called An Unlikely Vineyard. Well, we get a lot of books for On the Menu Radio, and I always try to read the books, which is not always easy, and it's not always achieved. But I must say that this book it's just poked out as like one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time. We're going to be talking to the author, Deirdre Hecken, and her book is called An Unlikely Vineyard, The Education of a Farmer and Her Quest for Terroir. And I think it's unlikely, Deirdre, that you would have picked Vermont to start your vineyard.
Well, that's true. I don't think I knew that was going to happen. I think I might have, if I had been able to plan it out, I might have picked somewhere in Italy first.
Yes. But, well, of course, you were in Tuscany. You lived there, and that's when you started getting the idea for the kind of lifestyle that you wanted to pursue, right?
Yes. So my husband and I had an opportunity to live and work there. And that experience just kind of, you know, turned our world around. And
where were you in Italy, in Tuscany?
So we were in eastern Tuscany, right on the border with Umbria.
Oh, it's pretty.
Yeah, it was beautiful, between two very well-known towns, Arezzo and Cortona.
Oh,
and our village, yeah, just beautiful. Our village was not very well known, so it was a great place for us to learn Italian and to immerse ourselves in the culture and meet lots of people. It was great. We couldn't have asked for a better place.
Well, you know, reading this book, I felt this great kinship for you. I mean, even to the point where I studied French for years and years, and then I went to school at the University of Florence. And the Italian pushed out all of my French,
yes,
just like you said. So I understood that immediately.
Yeah, and it's still a struggle to try and maintain the two, because I have a few opportunities. Well, I definitely get to speak Italian, but I do occasionally get an opportunity to speak French, and I try and keep that going as well.
Yeah. Now, you've set out to construct what I view as the perfect, idyllic life. Oddly, I guess when I was growing up, the idea was to actually set off to a big city and get immersed in that kind of activity. And you wanted to get immersed in the small rural environment where you're close to the earth. Tell us about that.
Right. So actually, when I got out of school, I would say it was the same, and that people were, I mean, I went to the city. I went to New York. I was really interested in film at the time, and I was working in film and television, and my husband was working for a literary agent, and we were really trying to embrace the city, and that was kind of what all our peers were doing as well. And it wasn't, again, as I said, it really wasn't until this experience living and working in Italy that we saw another way, and that there was a kind of lifestyle that embraced the land, embraced the table, embraced the kitchen, that was really appealing to us. And it had to do with how people lived their day-to-day lives, and that the importance of life really revolved around the table. And that really made a lot of sense to us in a way that was different than the energy, and certainly the city is inspiring and has energy, but
we just, I don't know, it just, it really struck us, and it totally rerouted us.
Now, did you realize it was going to be quite so much work?
No.
Now, let's,
if anybody realized that, would they ever do it?
Well, that's what surprised me. So let's give our listeners an idea, because we may not succeed in covering everything in the book in detail. Things sort of build one upon the other, upon the other, upon the other, upon the other. There's a little bit of a flavor of Under the Tuscan Sun, except that what Frances Mays, of course, was dealing with was the fact that her house was falling down. In your case, you were actually building something up. But it seems like you built one thing and then almost immediately you had another thing to deal with. And I don't know whether you sought that or whether that just sort of accidentally happened to you.
I think it's a combination of both. I think that our Caleb's nature and my nature tend to, we work on a project and we try and get it set up, and then we try and delve deeply into it and refine it, and then we're ready for the next piece. And sometimes those things happen very closely together, and I wouldn't say that one project is complete before the other one is started, particularly as we have moved forward. But our challenge is really juggling between these different projects, between our restaurant, between growing vegetables for the restaurant, now the evolution of a vineyard and making wine, and the wine going out into the world, and how all these things dovetail. And it's pretty much a 24/7 endeavor all year long.
At least.
At least, exactly. Exactly. I'd like to say it's about 42/7.
Yeah, you sort of don't get up in the morning with an empty list of things to do.
That is very, very true. Fortunately, we love everything we do, but it is a challenge. And trying to find, our goal is now to try and find balance within those things, because it is very important to also be able to take time to rest and time to rejuvenate. And right now, we are in so much transition, we have not had a lot of time to do that. So that's the goal while keeping all these things afloat.
Now talk about the restaurant. Now your husband functions in the kitchen now as a chef.
He does. The restaurant is very tiny. It's the two of us and an assistant or two. And Caleb is the chef. I am the sommelier, wine director, and manage the front of house. And we have about, depending on the evening and how many of us are on, we have, 6 to 8 tables. And it's one seating, a staggered seating. You can order simply a la carte, or you can do a four-course tasting menu. We have Tuscan pizza that we learned while living and working in Italy. We grow a good portion of the vegetables and now some of the livestock for the restaurant. And then, of course, a specialty in wine as a sommelier is Italian regional wine. But now, of course, we have our own wine on offer as well. So that's
now, what's
really
the name
wonderful.
Of the restaurant to start with?
The restaurant is called Osteria Pane e Salute.
Okay. And you're in what part of Vermont?
We are in what I would call South Central. We're in the village of Woodstock.
Oh, well, everybody should know that, right?
Well,
this is the other Woodstock. There's a Woodstock everywhere.
This is the other Woodstock.
This is the other Woodstock.
Yeah, the other Woodstock, the real Woodstock, they say, right? So we're about 2.5 hours from Boston and about 4.5 to 5 hours from New York,
well,
depending
let me,
on how you
let
drive.
Let me let you into a little secret. There is an earlier Woodstock.
Oh.
It's in Oxfordshire in South Central England.
Oh, of course. And I have been there.
Yeah, don't you love those gardens? I mean, you're going to have gardens just like the garden,
yes.
The gardens at Blenheim Palace, aren't you? One of these.
Yes,
days.
They are
just know
beautiful.
You are.
They
I
are
love
beautiful.
That place.
And of it's gorgeous.
And of course, you realize now there was a significant day, it's either just happened or it's about to happen, which is the celebration of the life of, as caused by the death of, 50 years ago, of a young man who was born in Blenheim Palace, but was not one of the family that owned it.
Uh-huh.
Winston Churchill.
Yes, that's right.
He happened to be born there, but he was the son of a younger son. As a result, he had no interest at all in the property from a financial standpoint.
There, yeah.
Well, since you, I mean, the climate is one thing in Vermont. I mean, most, I talked to a friend of mine who has a house there, and but he's a skier. And I've talked to a bunch of others are summer, sort of, and mud, snow and mud.
Snow and mud, it's true. And we also have, we used to say we had five seasons, the mud season being the fifth, but there are actually six. There's a season that we call stick season, which is in November when all the leaves are gone before the snow arrives.
Oh, well. But, you know, you went to a place where you would find a really strong and vibrant support system because, again, talking to this friend, he explained why all of these independent, creative people migrate to live in Vermont. So you were able to talk to neighbors and people, other farmers, probably artisanal producers, right?
Absolutely. So Caleb grew up in Vermont. So he has, and his father is from a many generation Vermont family. So he has a long history. My family used to come in the summertime to this area where we live now. So I had some experience here as a child, and then we both went to college here in Vermont. And so we had all those experiences before we decided to move here full time. And certainly there is an incredibly independent spirit here in every field. And it's been, you're absolutely right, it's been wonderful to connect with other farmers, other artists, other creators, cheesemakers, to share ideas and experiences of what it's like to do this kind of work here. And we have an incredibly vibrant agricultural community, small agricultural community that's happening here right now.
So much is going on.
Now let's go back to this wonderful book for just a few minutes, because we don't have time to do it justice, but we do want to point out what it is. Because it's actually a variety of different things. First of all, it's a lovely story.
Well, thank you.
So it's a storybook about Deirdre and Caleb growing up and building the farm they always dreamed of. It's one step at a time. The second thing it is, it's an instruction manual that says, here's how you can go about doing that for yourself, if you'd like. So it includes the best explanation I've ever seen of permaculture and biodynamic as opposed to organic. People want to know more about why you should do these things or why you should consider them. That's in there. The third thing, and the amazing thing, is it's an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
It's an encyclopedia that includes information on where all the different apple varieties came from
and
what they're good for, what's happening with bees in general, and especially what's causing colony collapse disorder. Why you should grow roses.
Oh, the history of roses, too. I mean, it's just amazing.
I love all that stuff.
I can't really figure out how you had time to do all this.
It took me a long time. It was a project that was 3 years in the making.
Tell our listeners a little bit about what they're going to find in each of those categories that I just mentioned.
So, yeah, I mean, I think you did a beautiful job describing it. It's part story, part memoir or biography of the evolution of our farm. And it's part practical, how we've done the things that we've done and what we've learned from that, recommendations of things to do and not to do, learning from our mistakes and learning from the positive things too. And you're right about, I hadn't really thought of it as being like an encyclopedia, but because I am so enamored with varietals of, you know, whether it's apples or roses and the history of things, that was something that was very important to me to include in the book. So, my hope was that it would be kind of like an assemblage of various pieces or like a diary, if you will, with drawings and photographs and little bits of information and then the narrative of the story to tie everything together. And the way it's structured is each chapter focuses on a particular area of our farm. So, of course, there's the vineyard, which is very much at the heart of the farm, the orchard, the vegetable garden, the winter garden, the bees, all these sort of different elements, taking you all the way through to the cantina where we make the wine. So I wanted to have all these separate pieces, but also show how they are very intimately connected.
Well, you did that.
Well, a lot of people have an unfortunate association with encyclopedias, so let me quickly point out that it's the friendliest encyclopedia ever want to read.
Oh, it's a fun read, actually.
I mean, you really want to turn over to the next page and find out what you're going to find next.
That's great.
And I also love the examples of that you mentioned. You said that you included the things that you did wrong and what you learned. So as a result, people who are tempted to go down the same pathway will have the benefit of the fact that you made many of the mistakes that they might make unless you told them this is what to do to avoid it.
Right, and it's actually the book I wish I had had when we started out, that I could have referred to. So that was another one of the overriding goals in my mind, what's the book that I would have wanted and the information that I was looking for. So I wanted to include those things.
Is there really effective dousing? I mean, it struck me as so odd.
Yes, dousing is an art form.
But it seems so archaic.
Well, hold on a minute. I got confused by the definition of dousing, because
finding water.
When you think of dousing, if I was going to douse somebody, I'd be thinking of the Gatorade.
Oh, no.
That the team is going to throw over their coach after they win the game.
Water.
Right. No, I figured that one out. Yes.
Right. So the thing about dowsing I think that's important to remember is that it is physics. So many of these things, I mean, they all are based on physics and chemistry. And when you are, the way I have learned to douse, and there are certainly people who can douse who have a real knack for it, who can douse with, old-fashioned dowsers will douse with sticks, with wooden sticks. I have always learned doing it with copper. With a copper, which I talk about, you know, you can take a copper wire out of an electrical wire and shape it and use that, use two of those to douse. And when you're dousing for something particular, like water, when you cross a water line, the copper reacts to the change in ionic. So the copper moves. And that's when you know you have found a space, for water, particularly if you're thinking of, you know, drilling a well. And that's, I think, many people think of dowsing in association with that. So, but it is incredible, and that anybody can do it. You don't have to have a special knack for it, for something as simple as finding a source of water. Uh-huh. There are very specific things that professional dowsers do that takes a lot of training, but everybody can do it.
Well, I don't know what part of the book I like best, but I sure would heartily recommend it to anybody, Deirdre.
Oh, thank you so much.
If you're not interested in doing the actual projects, you will enjoy reading about them, and your literary style is just very impressive.
Yeah, it's like an adventure story.
Thank you.
Especially if you don't leap forward to the book, which we did, of course. if you just take it in the order.
Well, you did more of that than I did. I got stuck, actually, following each sentence, reading the sentences, because she has such an expressive way of writing.
If you read it like a story, I think that's the way that you'll find it to be the most interesting and the most rewarding. And then you can always come back and say, well, now my tomatoes didn't grow. Now, why did that happen?
That's great. Well, you've got it exactly. That's how I totally intended for people to read the book.
And let me give you a clue as to the kind of wisdom that's in there, because this is a neighbor of yours, you said, who takes her tomato plants in the wintertime instead of throwing them in the garbage or even putting them in the compost heap. She actually brings them inside. They die back, just like vines, but then they come alive again when she plants them in the springtime.
Right. She's been able to, what's called, harden them off like
a
vine.
I know
and
what that is,
have
yeah.
them, yeah, really, really act like a vine or a tree. And it's remarkable. I have not attempted it yet, but I think it's a really interesting idea.
Now, does she keep them in the dark, or does she put does she have to keep them in light?
She keeps them in, you know, like a cool northern room. So there's light,
okay,
but
there is light.
It's not bright sunshine. And definitely the room stays cool because you do have to have some dormancy for the plant. So just like any other plant that you might bring in,
yeah,
in a pot, you want to keep it in a cooler space.
Yeah, like the fig trees in our climate, people bring those in. Yeah.
I don't know where we would do it.
I was going to do it next year, but I don't know where we would because we don't really have windows that satisfy that environment. Maybe we'll just
right. I mean, you know, but I would encourage you to experiment. You know, maybe it would do fine in something like a cellar, in a root cellar, and it would be really interesting to see how much light they need.
Well, we have a big cellar, for sure.
There you go. Try it, and then let me know how it works.
Well, we'll find some more fascinating things we can try in our tiny little garden. But in the meantime, do give our best wishes to Caleb. We hope you'll be able to get back to the restaurant tonight through the ice and snow, and that you'll make it through the winter for one more mud season at least.
And yes, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Deirdre, for talking to us.
Thank you, Ann and Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Who knew you could grow grapes in Vermont and all the other things you just learned? Fascinating story, right? And we'll be back with another fascinating story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to now look at the granddaddy of all specialty produce available in supermarkets, or rather, I guess we should say the grandmommy, because we're talking about Frieda Kaplan, and we're going to be talking to her daughter, Karen, about what an amazing, amazing venture it was to start Frieda's. Just warming up for this interview, I learned something important. Frieda's was not founded by Karen Kaplan. It was founded by her mother, who is now, did you say, Karen, 92?
No, Frieda Kaplan, my mother, is 91, almost 92 years old.
Okay.
And yes, she founded our company in 1962.
Oh, that long ago. My goodness.
Yes, we'll be celebrating 53 years this year.
Oh, wow.
What an amazing idea. 50 years ago, this must have been a really amazing idea.
Well, you know, 50 years ago, not very many women started companies. But the way my mother tells the story is that she had me a few years earlier, and she was looking for a job with flexible hours, like many women are when they have children. And my dad's aunt and uncle ran a produce company in the Los Angeles wholesale produce market. So she called them up because she heard they had crazy hours and said, did they know of anyone hiring? And as it turned out, their bookkeeper had just quit that day. So they offered my mom a job. This is back in 1956.
Oh,
and that's how she got her start in produce. And then 6 years later in 1962, the landlord of the wholesale produce market in Los Angeles had been watching my mom and the business she was building on exotic items like brown mushrooms and suggested she start her own company, which she did.
So he gave her the idea of exotic produce.
No, he gave her the idea of starting a company. He had watched her selling what at that time was considered an unusual product.
Yeah, Jacques Pepin said that he could not even buy fresh mushrooms in the supermarket when he first came to the U.S.
You could get white ones. You couldn't get brown ones.
Anyhow.
Well, it was my mother that was selling the brown ones.
Okay, there you go. And then she went on from there to somewhat more exotic things.
Yes, she did.
Well, I told you before that I encountered my first Frieda product in 1974 in Leawood, Kansas, in a supermarket, and it was Jerusalem artichokes, and I was blown away. I didn't even know they existed.
Yes, it's very interesting, the story of Jerusalem artichokes, which my mom renamed to be the name Sunchoke.
Yes.
That is the first product that she ever packaged. So these sunchokes, your listeners might wonder, what do they look like? So if you can imagine something that looks like ginger root, except it's refrigerated and it's a crunchy vegetable. That's what a sunchoke looks like. And the problem was, if they were just put out loose,
consumers couldn't really tell the difference between fresh ginger root and sunchokes.
Oh, my.
So my mother packaged them in 1 pound, overwrapped a bag, and labeled them sunchokes, and put them, sent them out to supermarkets across the United States, and they were an unbelievable success. And that's about the same time that she started packaging in purple. That's our company color. So if your listeners are wondering who is Frida's Specialty Produce and how would I know if it's Frida's product or where do I find it, they're always packaged with a purple label. That's the trademark color that my mom, the first sign that was put in front of my mom's building when she started her company was a pale lavender. She kept it.
Now, this was still a business that was conducted in a wholesale fruit and vegetable market?
Yes. When my mom started, it was really, really old-fashioned, if you can imagine, back in the 60s. Literally, the buyers would... My mom would get there at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was dark, obviously. The buyers would walk the walk, and these are buyers from Los Angeles and other buyers who were shipping all over the country. They would actually walk down the produce market examining various fruits and vegetables, and they would place their orders. She did some pioneering things at that time, besides the unusual fruits and vegetables, is she sold by telephone. So she was not afraid to get up and call people on the phone and talk about her produce by telephone, whether it was in Los Angeles or it was across the country. Also, she was the first person who shipped produce in refrigerated air containers. So when we brought in the first mushrooms from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, to California, we obviously flew them in refrigerated containers. So she did a lot of pioneering things, but yes, we started at the Los Angeles Wholesale Produce Market.
Now, she has to have been a remarkable woman. You have to reconstruct for us some more about what this situation was like, how she expanded the product offerings. Did she study food geographies, or what did she do?
My mom, I've been working side by side with my mom since 1977. And we've always said that the success of our business has really been a little bit of luck, a little bit of destiny, and a lot of great timing. So literally, this was before the internet, before fax machines, before digital cameras. So really, your reputation and your word really spread, good or bad. And my mom developed this amazing reputation, not only in Southern California and the United States, but by word of mouth around the world. She was very open to any opportunities that came to her. So literally, she did not have, she was a one-woman show. I mean, Jan had a few employees, maybe 10 employees, but she was at work at 1 o'clock in the morning, going home at 5 in the evening. She worked a long day.
Oh, wow.
So literally, it was word of mouth. People said, there's that lady in Los Angeles, that lady with that different kind of name, Frida, and she'll try anything. So I'm not sure if you're aware that after the California brown mushroom, that probably the product my mom is most famous for introducing is the Chinese gooseberry, which, of course, you probably will recognize by
kiwi.
The name she changed it to. Yes, the kiwi fruit. So literally, they came to her. People had products from all over the country, from all over the world, and they didn't know who could sell them, who would even be interested. This is before Whole Foods was in business. And they would come down the walk, and they would offer the product to various people, and they all said the same thing. Not interested, go see Frida. She'll talk to anybody.
Now, of course, she didn't invent the name kiwi fruit because we call New Zealanders kiwis.
Right. It was one of the guys she did business with, the export agents that suggested that the Chinese gooseberry wasn't a very marketing-oriented name. And maybe, since they weren't from China and they're not gooseberries, and maybe she should consider, because they resembled the flightless, hairless bird of New Zealand, the kiwi, that maybe they should call the fruit by the same name. Maybe they should call it kiwi fruit.
But
she's the one who really launched it worldwide.
Now, I would dispute whether a kiwi fruit looks like a kiwi.
you have to have a lot of imagination in our business.
You do have to have a lot of it. Now, I think something happened at the same time as Frida's was growing, and that's a change in the attitude of the American retail buyer. So I guess Mom was really in the right place at the right time.
So tell me what you mean about the retail buyer.
Well, in terms of, I shop at Whole Foods almost every day.
They got more adventurous.
Because it happens to be only 400 yards from my house, and I quite like the walk. But I think that 25 or 30 years ago, Whole Foods themselves would probably have failed. what was happening at the same time as they were trying to grow, and as your mother's business was flourishing, what it turned out that people were suddenly more interested in exotic things. They were no longer interested in carrots and cabbage and lettuce and things like that. They were looking for more exotic things anyway.
It was the beginning of the food revolution, particularly in California.
Right. So I would say that you're right, Peter, but it really wasn't, with all due respect to retail buyers, it really wasn't the buyers that were being open-minded in the beginning. It was exactly what you said. Consumers were beginning to travel around the world. They were getting kind of bored with all those basic carrots and tomatoes and regular potatoes. But they didn't have the internet. You know, they had a few cookbooks. Julia Child really wasn't on the scene yet. But they would go and they would ask for things at the supermarket. And my mom's timing was impeccable. So we had all these growers who wanted to move their products. And my mom was honestly very charming and very convincing. And, surprise, surprise, when the retailer, the supermarket buyer, put the product out on display, even though he did not eat it, didn't like it, didn't know what it was, it still sold. So when you have success, when the consumer buys it, of course you're encouraged, so you come back and try it some more. But really, the way we kind of built the business was, because there was no internet, and because our buyers, the supermarket buyers, really were not at that time foodies, and they really didn't know anything about the products, is the way we were successful is we became also a source of information. So actually, when I started out of college in 1977, my job was to talk to every food editor in America, get to know them personally, and make sure information about our products was available so they could write about them in food sections, talk about them on the radio, that was before internet radio, and really let consumers know what to do with the products. And then we started packaging our products so that the supermarket buyer wasn't concerned that no one would know what the product was. So in a way, we were kind of educating the produce manager along with labeling the product. Kind of a perfect storm. So we have these awesome products that taste good. Now we package them with information so the buyer knows that they'll be properly labeled. We're kind of educating the produce manager. And then when the consumer comes in, after they've seen a recipe or read an article or now watch it on the TV Food Network, they come in and they go, oh, that's radicchio, or that's a purple sweet potatoes, or that's shallot. They can connect the dots and then they buy the product.
So it really was just
great timing.
Now, hold on a bit. Tell us about these wonderful things called butter babies.
Oh, I wanted to ask you something else.
They're the ones that Anne fell in love with. But
I wanted to ask, first of all, did you ever approach marketing to chefs themselves, wholesaling?
Oh, yes, of course. Quite a bit of our business is selling food service, chefs, restaurateurs, and food service distributors. So what we found, Anne, was that actually in the beginning, the chefs were, they still are our saviors, because the chefs, for us, chefs like Wolfgang Puck, Alice Waters, Michael McCarty, they were the first people that would try all of these new products. So they would serve them in their restaurants, they would put them on the menu. Those food editors I mentioned earlier, they would put photographs with the kiwi and the portobello mushrooms and things like that on the covers of their magazines. And consumers would either see the new products or they would taste them at a restaurant, and then they would come home and say, well, I want to cook with portobello mushrooms at home.
Which is a great example of a marketing campaign gone successful. I mean, the portobello mushrooms are nothing but overgrown mushrooms, but they were packaged and presented as something very special.
Yes.
So it's a coup for the marketing industry.
So, Peter, you asked about the butter baby potatoes.
Yes, yes. We Anne adores potatoes.
It's terrible. I mean,
she's actually close to comparing butter babies to a product which comes from the Channel Islands in England called Jersey Royals.
Jersey Royals. I love those.
Oh, I've heard of those.
Oh, they're fabulous.
They are the most fantastic potatoes, but butter babies are pretty good too. Now, tell us the story of them, because this is not at all like a potato.
Well, it's very interesting because I know that your show, your segment is heard around the world, and we've actually just started growing them, and we're doing just as a pilot this year in 2014, 2015. And so we've been looking for years for a small creamy, almost sweet yellow flesh potato that was small that you could boil or microwave or mash or saute or roast, and it just had an amazing mouthfeel. And literally, we've been looking for 5 or 10 years. And in a little farm in Idaho on a test plot, we found these potatoes, and we had all of our salespeople test them, and we've just eaten a lot of potatoes around here, and we decided that we wanted to do a test this year. So we've actually grown, I can't tell you how much, but a small amount of potatoes. We're actually test marketing them this year in 3 geographic areas for supermarkets, and we're sending them out to some chefs, just letting them play around with them this year. And then we hope next year, which will start in September of 2015, the next season, we're hoping we're going to have wider distribution.
You see, that was one of my questions. How involved do you get? I mean, we've interviewed apple breeders, for example. That's a whole other, I mean, that's really a strange lot of people. I mean, they spend 20 years producing the exactly the right combination of this and that into their apples. And then we interviewed the guy about the, what were those things called? Pleurots, which is another
pleurots,
which is another whole thing. How involved do you get in actually instigating the development of these exotic products?
Well, I would say that we're not very active in the breeding. I mean, we're not breeders. We're marketers, marketer distributors. So what we do typically is people who are breeding will come to us and say, what do you think of this product? Like, we have a cutting edge, I can't tell you the name, it's top secret, product that's being, was developed in Israel, and we saw it about 5 or 6 years ago, and they've been playing around with it. They came back to us this year trying to perfect the growing on this product. It has amazing flavor, I can't even tell you what it is, but the breeders come to us because they know that we have a pulse on, for sure, the American consumer's palate. And then if we find something we really like, we may go to one of our growers and have them grow them for us. Or sometimes a breeder will be working, partnering with a grower, and they'll refer the grower to us, and then we'll do all the marketing. So we're more or less giving feedback.
Because I was asking, Peter and I had a little discussion. You sent us some purple cauliflower, and I said that it's a standard in southern Italy, purple cauliflower. So it wasn't something you developed. It was something that was already there, and you took it, as you said, and marketed it.
Yes. There are many, many fruits and vegetables around the world. This is based on my experience that we don't get here in the United States. Now, there are people who just love food and love the very different, unusual, fantastic tasting varieties of products. And here in America, we're very geared to high volume, standard sizing, no blemishes, no bruising, perfect looking products. Mm-hmm. And what happens when you have those product, that kind of standard, you kind of leave a lot of things off the, well, take them off the plate, literally. So I think what's happening is with consumers are getting so fascinated with food and good tasting food and wonderful flavors and what the mouthfeel is like, and they want to hear what the different chefs, you know, what did Anthony Bourdain find on his latest trip. And so now we as American consumers are a lot more open to some of these unusual varieties. I will tell you, we've been selling purple, green, orange, regular size cauliflower, and baby cauliflower for decades.
Aren't they cute? Those cute little ones, the pointy ones, what are those called?
Those are called Romanesco.
Oh,
those are the lime green ones.
Oh, aren't they gorgeous?
The lime green ones with the kind of, they look like they came from Star Trek.
Yes, I love
them. But we've been selling these for many, many years, like decades. But, you know, it's gradually then suddenly. It takes a very long time for many of these products that we introduce to catch on. In fact, my mom loves to talk about the kiwi fruit story. She introduced the first kiwi fruit in 1962, and it wasn't until 1980 that it started to catch on. So she lovingly calls it her 18-year overnight success story.
That's good. That's very good. So, but you do find that probably there's a much wider market for a much wider influx of exotic plants and fruits right now?
Yeah, consumers are definitely more open to anything unusual. The challenge, and I'm going to just talk from the supermarket viewpoint, is supermarkets
space.
Are getting smaller, not bigger.
Space, yeah.
Yeah, and they don't have a lot of room in the produce department. So a lot of supermarkets are saying, well, I'm not going to offer everything available. So what happens for consumers, which, you know, is great, it gives you an opportunity to meet the farmer, is especially if you have good year-round weather, then it's year-round. If not, it's just when it's not snowing and raining. You go to farmers markets, and these farmers grow these amazing varieties, and you can meet the farmer and buy whatever you want to try it, all the unusual varieties with amazing flavors.
Well, I think you have a fascinating story, and I'm glad that we can spread the word about it. And your mother sounds phenomenal, and our best to her as well.
Thank you. Well, she still comes in to work every day at 91 and a half.
Jeez, Karen, she's, hope you got her jeans.
Me too.
Okay, so hopefully we'll keep our dialogue going.
Well, thank you so much. It was very nice speaking with you, Ann and Peter.
Well, boys, it seems like we've had a lot of veggies in today's program.
Fruits
and veggies for Passover, fruits and veggies being grown in Vermont, and fruits and vegetables being distributed all over the country. Maybe we better have a different subject for next week, but the only way you'll find out is if you have to tune in to the same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.